All right. Today is September 27th, 2013. This is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the Department of History, and I'm here to interview Dan Sandwise in his office about his experiences with the Climate Change Institute. So just to get us started, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how you came to be interested in archaeology.
Yeah, I was not planning to be an archaeologist when I started college. I thought I was probably going to be an English major, but we were required to take one course per semester that was outside of our general area. So if you were in arts and humanities, which were divisions 1 and 2, you had to take something in divisions 3 or 4, which were social sciences and natural sciences. And I had no interest at all in natural science. Didn't do a lot of math, wasn't that into it. So I looked at the catalog, and there was a course in the Aegean Bronze Age archaeology course in the classics department, and I said, that could be fun. So I took that course, and it was absolutely fascinating. So the next semester, for my requirement course, I took an anthro course on world archaeology in the old world, Africa and Europe. And there were about 60 people in the class, and I'd say 55 of them were bored to tears, and 5 of us were on the edges of our seats. I was one of them, and I said, hey, you know, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. So the next semester, I took 3 archaeology courses, including a digging class that met on Saturdays all day in the fall, and then I was hooked.
This was by your sophomore year?
Yeah. By the end of the fall semester, sophomore year, I was a declared archaeology major and totally hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The ability to go out and dig things up and learn something from them was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of maybe doing it in other parts of the world was also really interesting.
So you participated in several digs while an undergraduate?
I did. We had the digging class where we dug a historic site outside of New Haven in fall of 1977 when I was a sophomore. No, 76, fall 76. And the next summer of 77, I went with one of the grad students as his field assistant. We flew to Mexico and sort of bussed our way down various stops looking at sites and so on to Guatemala City. Got our permit, went down and did a month of field work on the Pacific coast of southern Guatemala near the El Salvador border. And we weren't digging, we were looking for sites and identifying them and collecting things from the surface. So that was my real first out-of-the-country prehistoric archaeology experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year after my junior year, I spent the summer in Peru because I'd read a book in a class I was taking on a theory that ancient Andean civilizations on the coast were built on the basis of marine resources rather than agriculture, and that was interesting to me. So I got in touch with the author and then went down, and he helped me out, and I did a project interviewing fishermen to find out how they collected shellfish and so on, because I was interested in that particular aspect of marine resources and what you could get from that.
It sounds like you actually got involved in ethnographic research.
I did,
okay.
Yeah, early on, that was the good advice from this archaeologist who had written the book that inspired me. He said, you know, if you're going to dig up these things and study them and get information from them archaeologically, you better find out what local people know about them now. That's a great source of information. So mm-hmm. I traveled up and down the coast with a Peruvian colleague interviewing fishermen
mm-hmm.
about the different species and what they knew about their habits and where they collected them, the technology they used, all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun, and it has been useful ever since. It was mm-hmm. good advice. So then I came back and I applied to graduate school, and I got in and got fellowships and so on. So I started grad school in the summer of 1979 and then almost immediately went to Peru for a year.
Mm-hmm.
I had one of those Fulbright fellowships that let you just sort of do what you want
mm-hmm.
all around a general theme, and then I spent the year on various projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been every year pretty much since.
And you went straight from your master's to PhD working in Peru again.
Well, actually, at Cornell, where I did my PhD, the anthro department didn't want master students. You applied directly into the PhD program. You didn't do a master's thesis. You just took your comps. If you passed your comps at a high enough level, you were then both granted a master's on the way and admitted to candidacy for the PhD.
Mm.
So I didn't, in fact, do a master's thesis. I was in a PhD program at the beginning. I wasn't a PhD candidate till I passed comps, but I was in the program.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So, for your dissertation, you concentrated on the interviews you had conducted?
No, actually, by that point, I had become involved in multiple excavation projects, and the one I designed for my dissertation was to take an early historic record, what we call an ethnohistoric record, about fishermen at the time of the Inca Empire and their economic organization and how it differed from what was happening in other parts of the empire in the highlands, which had a very different system or was supposed to, mm-hmm. and decided to test that through excavation. So mm-hmm. that's what I did for dissertation work. Mm-hmm. But I had when I got to Cornell, because I was interested in the earth science aspects as well, and how understanding landform development and geological processes impinged upon archaeological sites and what people were able to do, and I was also interested in climate and foodways. I actually had a geologist on my committee, and I did a formal. We had majors and minors. So my major was anthropology, my minors were archaeology and geomorphology, which is land surface processes. Mm-hmm. So I actually had a pretty interdisciplinary education to begin with, even as a grad student.
Mm-hmm. You know. So how did you come to the University of Maine?
Oh, I was very lucky. When I was almost done with the dissertation, I was in Peru on another project. I was with a couple of colleagues who were faculty elsewhere. I was still a grad student. We'd gotten some NSF money to follow up an aspect of using shells to track ancient El Nino events. And so I had funding from this grant to go down and collect shells from various archaeological sites that had been excavated previously. Mm-hmm. And consequently, I got to stay in good hotels instead of what I usually did as a grad student, which was at the very bottom end. The dollar a night, $2 a night place with the reed roof and the shared bathroom and no toilet paper and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This, I was staying in really nice hotels. Mm. Which in those days in Peru didn't cost you like $30, $40 a night, but beyond my normal budget. And I was in a hotel in a city called Chiclayo, which is in northern Peru. And I was with another grad student who agreed to help me for a while, but I prefer not to travel alone, mm-hmm. driving up and down the coast. And we were going to check out of the hotel, and we were waiting in line, and the clerk said to this older gentleman standing next to me, "Dr. Hardall, you have a telegram." So I turned, this is, of course, way before internet or anything else, telegrams still existed. So I turned and said, "Excuse me, but are you Tor Hardall of Kontiki fame?" And he said that he was. And I said, "Oh, I'm Dan Sandweiss. I'm a grad student at Cornell. I'm working at an ancient fishing site in southern Peru, and I work on El Nino." And he said, "Oh, that's great. We need to meet. We need to talk. Meet me in the bar at 4 o'clock. So we didn't check out. We stayed. And at 4 o'clock, we met him in the bar, and we talked for 4 hours about all sorts of stuff. A fascinating, marvelous individual. And, I'd read Kon-Tiki as a kid for summer reading for 7th grade, and, he was old enough that he was still very famous in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So it was great. It was just great. I met him. At the end of this conversation, he said, "Do you know a site called Tucumán?" I said, "Yeah, I've been there. It's a great site." He said, "Well, I've decided to start a project there. Would you be interested in working on my project?" "Yeah, if I could start in 6 months when I finish my dissertation, that would be great." He said, "Well, do you think Cornell would be interested in sponsoring the excavation?" I said, "No, I'm just a grad student, and even the faculty have to get grants from somewhere else to fund their research." I was very disappointed. I remember thinking, the whole thing, he heard Cornell, he thought they had money. It was all a buildup mm-hmm. to see if he could get some money, because I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. So he said, "All right, here's my address. Give me your address. See what you can do to get down to the site next February, and I'll see what I can do to get you down there." Mm-hmm. And he gave me a book, and he signed it, and he said goodbye, and I said, "Wow, I just spent 4 hours with Tor Hardall, mm-hmm. one-on-one or two-on-one. It was a fantastic conversation. It was great." Yeah. I figured that was it. I would never hear anything again. And I knew I didn't have any way to get funding to go down and work on this project that hadn't started yet. Mm-hmm. So that was July. In October, I was in my office at the university working on my dissertation. And I got this phone call. This woman asked for me, and I said, "It was me." She said, "Fred Olson of Timex would like to talk to you." So I said, "What does he want to talk to me about?" She wouldn't tell me. I remember thinking, "Yeah, he's going to try and sell me a watch. Maybe I should just hang up." But I was curious, so thank goodness I stayed on the line. They put on this Fred Olson. He said, comes on, and I said, "Tor Hardall called me up, and he wants to know what you need to come work at Tucumán for the next 1 to 3 years. FedEx are faxing me your proposal in 2 days because I'm going to Europe in 5 days. Wow. And then we chatted some more, and then he put me back in the secretary. I said, "Well, because I needed the address to send to FedEx, because I didn't know what a fax was. They'd just been invented, and I had no idea what that was, but I knew what FedEx was. So I asked the secretary, what does Fred Olson do at Timex? He said, "What does he do? He owns it. The Olsons are the richest family in Norway. They're old family friends of the Heyerdahls. Fred's dad had helped Tor early on. Fred himself had grown up during the World War II in Connecticut with Heyerdahl's first wife and his two sons, because they had been refugees in North America during the war while he went off and fought with the Free Norwegian troops. And so, you know, he felt that he had inherited a responsibility to help Tor with whatever he wanted. So when Tor called him up and said, you know, I want you to get me Sandwise, he did.
Wow.
So then I talked to my advisor, you know, said, all right, you know, should I do this? And all the people, out there said, yeah, you should. There's, you know, there are no jobs. And besides, he's got a very good record. He does what he wants, but he always lets the archaeologists publish their material for real, the way they, you know, whatever they see. Worth working with him. Mm-hmm. So, well, you know, what should I ask for? $500 a month and an airfare, maybe an airfare for my wife, too. And he said, my advisor said, no, you're about to get a PhD from Cornell. If you didn't do this, you would try to get a job as an assistant professor. So find out what the best places are paying for assistant professors. You ask for that on a 9-month contract. And whatever it is, it's going to look like small change to Timex. So I did. I found out what, you know, places like Yale were paying. Mm-hmm. And I knew that was close to them. So I asked for, I think, $33,000 a year. This was in 1989, actually end of 88. Mm-hmm. And 9-month contract. And, you know, 10 personal days. And I sent it in, and they called me down, and I drove down to Connecticut from Ithaca, and I interviewed. We talked for a long time, and then he said, all right, you know, he called in somebody, and it was this guy, and so-and-so. He's the VP for personnel, and he has a contract for you. You can take a look at it. You know, we checked, and, you know, what you asked for, it's on the high end for somebody like you, but we called the nearest university, which was Yale. They said, yeah, that's all right. So, you know, it has what you want, but take a look. If you need to change something, let us know. And then I went off with the VP and talked to him. It turns out we'd been in the same residential college 10 years apart in undergraduate, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I took the contract. I sent it to a friend of mine who would become a corporate lawyer. And he said, this is a great contract. It's entirely in your favor. Once both sides sign, they're more obligated than you are. Sign the contract. So I did.
Wow.
And in February, my wife and I flew down. Actually, what they did is they gave me $35,000 and said, you cover your airfares. That actually was, they were less than $1,000 round trip, so it worked out quite well. Got what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I got a raise every year for the 3 years I did it.
Yeah.
Wow. It was, so that's what I did for my first 3 years after the doctorate. Mm-hmm. And in the third year, one of my mentors, who was a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, but also the head of anthropology at the Carnegie Museum, also in Pittsburgh, offered me a postdoc so I could come back to the States. And, you know, cause I knew that I had to come back at some point to look for a real job. Mm-hmm. So I told Tor, you know, I'm going to go back. I helped him find somebody else. He said, well, you know, we want you to come back every summer, so we'll give you some money to come back and, you know, spend a month every summer until we finish up the project. You know, that was for 2 more years. And I went in January of 1992, I went to Pittsburgh and I started the postdoc. It paid a lot less, but it was a great place to be. I was having a good time. And my mail had been going to Ithaca, but it finally caught up with me at the end of March. And I had a whole bunch of something called the Anthropology Newsletter. It's a, you know, trade newsletter for the National Association, and it's the one that where all the jobs are listed. Mm-hmm. So I started looking through all of them, and I got to the March one, and it had this job at the University of Maine. They were looking for somebody in anthropology and what was then the Institute for Quaternary Studies who worked in the New World, preferentially in South America, who did climate change but also worked on complex societies. In those days, that was a pretty rare combination. Mm-hmm. So I went to Jim Richardson, my supervisor, my mentor there. I said, look, you know, I see this job, and I know I'm supposed to be here for, you know, the better part, pretty much 2 more years, but what do you think? He looked at it and he said, you'd be crazy not. That's your job. You'd be crazy not to apply for it. So I did, mm-hmm. and I got onto the list for interviews at the National Archaeology meetings. I think they invited 9 people. Mm-hmm. Dave Sanger came to the meeting to do that as the lead archaeologist, the person in charge of the search. Fortunately for me, I would have gone anyway probably, but the meeting actually was in Pittsburgh, so I didn't have to go anywhere. It was, you know, right there downtown, very convenient. And I met Dave, and he took me to lunch, and we ended up talking for over 2 hours, which is, I think, more than he was supposed to. We hit it off really well. Mm-hmm. He'd already read publications and so on. And then I was one of the 2 people they invited on campus for an interview a month or so later, which was good. And there was a 3rd person who had been in the immediately previous search that ended up hiring Chris Soblik, and they put him back on the list, but I don't think they just to fill up the list, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then the other guy who came, I hear just as a rumor that at some point he made some remark about Maine being, you know, the boondocks or something, and that killed his candidacy. So that left me, and they hired me, and that's how I got here.
So you were hired with the expectation that you would be joint archaeology and quaternary.
I was hired in a, I was hired under the EPSCoR grant
okay.
that the Institute had. So I was a new line. They hired two archaeologists who were split that year. The first search, they got Chris Sobolik, who just recently left. Well, she was associate dean, so you probably knew of her or knew her.
I'm not sure.
Okay, she was in the associate dean for the last couple of years in CLAS, and she left in January last year.
Okay.
Anyway, and she was replacing somebody who had been split between the two who had left, and then they got this big EPSCoR grant, big NSF grant, institution building thing for multiple thousands, millions of dollars over 5 years that allowed them to hire a bunch of faculty members, and I was one of those. That was my position.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a new position created, funded by the grant for 3 years, and then the university was obligated to keep the position funded in, ad infinitum. That was the deal with the government. If you get one of those grants and you hire people, you have to keep them, keep the line open. You might not keep the person there if they're not good enough, but you have to keep the line.
Right.
So that was my hire. Kirk Mosh was hired under that same grant, and then a bunch of people aren't here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were talking about the other, we think we're the last two from the EPSCoR cohort of 1991, 1992.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think your research contributes to our understanding of climate change?
In a variety of ways. One is that the work I do produces actual climate records. Because they're important because the area where I work is the coast of Peru is a core region for El Nino, but it doesn't have many of the common high-resolution climate proxies that, or they're not fully applicable to that area, even though it's a very climatically important area. So there aren't very many cores from the ocean floor nearby, and most of them are missing a critical time in the middle of the Holocene.
Mm-hmm.
Ice cores are in the Andes adjacent to the coast, but they partly reflect what's happening coming off of the Atlantic across the Amazon, so they're not a complete record of what's happening on the Pacific shore.
Mm-hmm.
There are no corals because the water's too cold. There's a cold current comes up on the coast of Peru, so they don't have corals. Those are most of the major. Well, the other one would be lakes, and it's a desert, so there are essentially no lakes, certainly none that have a great time depth. There's some that form at the ends of irrigation canals and reflect irrigation practices more than climate.
Mm-hmm.
So in the absence of many direct records, natural records of climate, we've been able to take natural objects, formerly living things, shells and fish principally,
mm-hmm.
and look at them in terms of their habitat preferences, the chemistry that make up the bones and the shells, and so on, and use that, their growth patterns, to get a look at an actual record of climate,
mm-hmm.
of marine climate along the coast in this core area of El Nino.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been important. We were ahead of the curve in recognizing changes in the frequency of El Nino events during the Holocene. Now everybody knows that happened, and there are multiple records around the Pacific Basin that show it. We really were the first people to identify this, and we did it on the basis of archaeological remains or marine remains from archaeological sites.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be probably the major contribution. And then we also work on trying to understand how the changes in climate that we see impacted people's lives throughout time along the coast of Peru. So it's the human-environment connection as well.
Mm-hmm. How far back, some of these items, like fish fossils?
Well, they're not fossils, they're bones.
Fish bones.
Yeah.
How far back?
Until recently, the oldest sites we had in Peru were 13,000 years old. And actually, the oldest for years was the one that I had excavated in the 90s in southern Peru.
Mm-hmm.
There is one site now that has a few dates and a small amount of remains that's about 14,000 years old. So 1,000, mm-hmm. maybe 1,200 years older. And there may be more, but we haven't found them yet.
Mm-hmm.
So a strong record from 13,000 years and a little tiny bit for the millennium before that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of climate, fairly recent record, but nevertheless an important record.
It's the period in which humans have been in the New World. It's the period in which agriculture and animal domestication has occurred throughout the world, in which people have gone from nomadic bands of hunters, gatherers, and fishers to settled complex societies, eventually states, and now these mega states that we have. So it's the most critical period in human history when everything has accelerated tremendously. And that's all happened within climatic contexts, and we have a piece of that story, both for what happened to human societies in Peru, but also to what the Peruvian situation says about climate generally. So,
pretty much everyone I've spoken to in the Institute has stressed the interdisciplinary character of the Institute. Has it been difficult for you to engage in interdisciplinary work with other scholars because you're working in Peru?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I would never really consider going somewhere else has been the incredible ease of being interdisciplinary here and getting people to join me in my research. So the first person from the faculty here who went down with me to Peru was in 1995. I'd been here for 2 years. Professor Faulkner, who's now passed away, a historic archaeologist, came with me to Peru. We were looking at some historic sites and talking about maybe doing some El Nino archaeology and historic sites where we would know what had really happened and see what it looked like. We haven't done that, but it was a plan. So he was the first. And then, I don't know, 96, Kirk Mosh came with me, and we looked at beach ridges and the effect of El Nino on beach ridge formation. We've published a lot on that, and we've done other things. Then 97, and Dan Belknap came down, and we brought two students that we were advising, and we were again following up on the beach ridges. Mm-hmm. In 97 or 98, it was Hal Borns, the founder of the Institute, came. We were looking at obsidian sources and the effect of glacial movements in making sources available or not available.
Can you go into a little more detail about the work you and Hal did together?
Yeah, it was just the one trip. I had been working on the coast on this site that turned out to be a very early fishing site. And one of the things we found in it was obsidian, which is a volcanic glass that has a one particularly useful property for archaeologists, which is that every flow, every source of this basically has a different chemical signature. So if you look at the chemistry of the objects, you find the pieces of obsidian. It could be little tiny bits left over from making a tool, whatever. And characterize the obsidian from natural sources throughout the area, you can tell where something came from. So an archaeologist at Yale had done a lot of work trying to find the major obsidian sources and characterize them for the Andes. When we got obsidian from the site Quebrada Hawaii, I sent it to him, and he analyzed it, and he told us it came from a source called Alca. And that was interesting, because Alca is one of the two biggest sources in southern Peru, more or less adjacent to near the site, 100 and some kilometers away up in the mountains, but in the same general region. There was another source called Chivay, which was only a little bit further from the site, later in prehistory, at least as important. And the route to get to it appeared to be a better route, better watered and so on, easier travel to get to it. So given that every piece of obsidian we found came from Alca and not Chivay, so anyway, well, why would that be? Okay, the Chivay source is much higher altitude than the Alca source. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the area had been glaciated up into the time when the site was occupied. So the question I had was this Chivay source not used because it was covered with glaciers, or was it not used because they hadn't found it, or because that was in somebody else's territory? And the easiest part of that to solve was to try and figure out whether it had been covered by glaciers or not. So I turned to Hal.
Gotcha.
To say, can you help me with this? And although he was already, I think, in his 70s and had atrial fibrillation, he said, of course, I'll come with you. And we got some money from the university, and we went down, and we were living at 3,600 meters and going up to 4,600 to work, and we looked at the terrain around the obsidian source and collected some samples for what was then a new dating technique. Mm-hmm. We got several samples dated. The one that was most directly relevant came back to the right time to have covered the site with ice, but it was still an experimental technique. Mm-hmm. So this summer, finally, one of my students, one of the other students, went back to follow up on this study that Hal and I started now, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. which is really cool.
It is.
So waiting to see what results they get from it. But now that this dating technique is much more established, it can be done much more precisely. And frankly, they were younger and able to get around more. So my hope is that they will now be able to have a really definitive. We had a sort of quasi-answer to the question, but I think they can get the definitive one that we can move forward to the next step of research on that.
Fascinating. So I take it you and Hal never published a paper on...
We did not publish a paper on that because we weren't confident enough that the dating was correct. And with only one sample it's hard to say that you really know what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
So we were pretty certain we knew the answer, but we didn't think we knew it well enough to publish a paper on it,
mm-hmm.
which is why we needed somebody to go back and finally got somebody to do it. I don't personally, I rarely work in the Highlands. I'm a coastal person. There's no oxygen up there.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me. Hal, however, had no problem at all. He was just fine until we went back to the Lowlands, and he ate something bad and got sick, but I mean, not really, but he was. But up in, you know, there, despite all of his health issues, he did incredibly well up there, and Hal's just a machine. It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's,
well, he's still an active scholar.
He is. It's amazing.
It's inspiring.
Great. It is inspiring.
Shifting topics here. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how you came to be dean of the graduate school.
Oh, another accident. Everything happens by serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
I had been, early in my time in the university, I was appointed, elected, whatever, by the Institute to be the representative to the graduate board. I found that it wasn't a very onerous task and it was really interesting. So I did that from, I think, my second year here until I became the dean.
Mm-hmm.
And then for about 5 years, I joined the executive committee, which is sort of the core group that advises the dean and works closely on setting the agenda for the grad board meetings and so on. And I found that it was really interesting. And we had one particular crisis came up, and I guess I took something of a leadership role in crafting the response of the graduate school to an attack on its existence, basically. So that was about a year before the position came open. Then at that time, there was an interim dean appointed for 3 years, or maybe not called it, but appointed for 3 years without a search. And that's the maximum anybody can go here in a position without having a formal search. So they decided they had to have a search. And so the woman named Deidre McGeehan, who was a demographer, I think. So we all knew, you know, she's doing a great job. It's going to be her. So I didn't apply for the job. And then she took a position at East Carolina University at a higher level, a vice chancellor position. And they had to reopen the search, and then lots of people applied, including me, and somehow I got selected.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because one of my friends said, yeah, you should be, you know, you're interested, you should do that. Yeah, they won't elect you, but it'd be interesting for you to try it. And then they selected me, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, more than 8 years later, here I am,
mm-hmm.
still doing, because I like doing this job. Mm-hmm. It lets me keep my hand in as a faculty member and as a researcher, but also do interesting things on the administrative side and working with grad students across campus, which I find very interesting.
So you still advise graduate students?
I do.
Do you teach any courses still? Or
I don't normally teach. Occasionally I'll do, say, a one-credit seminar,
mm-hmm.
although this semester I'm co-teaching a 400-level course in Spanish with my wife because mm-hmm. her department chair asked me to do that for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I am. I mean, she's really doing all the work. I just go to class when I'm free.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I'm not supposed to teach. Mm-hmm. My position, I'll make this stuff. My position is not supposed to include teaching. So mm-hmm. if I do it, it's sort of off the books. That's unpaid and not officially recognized.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk briefly about how you see your roles and responsibilities as the dean?
My job as the dean, as I see it, the principal job is to make certain that graduate studies at the University of Maine are characterized by a high degree of professionalism and by high quality, both on the part of the faculty and on the part of the students, that the experience that students have is as successful as we can make it be, that problems get resolved in a timely way, that we did craft policies which will make the experience better and the outcomes better for our students.
What kinds of policies?
Policies, for instance, on the kinds of programs that we can put together to be more responsive to the needs of students in the state or elsewhere who might want to come here. Policies on credits and how credits are counted and how what you can transfer and how you can transfer it. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we have, it's, I don't know, 100 pages long, so we have a lot of policies.
Sure.
Yeah.
What measures do you think the graduate school is able to take to make sure that its graduate students are productive?
The first is to help the departments be rigorous in their selection of graduate students. So we set base criteria. You know, you're not supposed to, and no department should accept a student with a lower than a 3.0 GPA, for instance. We don't set a role, level on GREs. We do for TOEFL scores for foreign and non-native speakers have to have a certain level. So that's one of the things we can do. We provide the whatever funding we can, as you know, to support students who are doing important work.
Right.
We work with students who have problems with their advisors to help them get over to find another advisor so that that's not an impediment to moving forward. We partner with CETA and with the grad student government to provide professional development opportunities. We do workshops on how you do your thesis. We actually have been co-sponsoring with CLAS a workshop for people actually writing theses and dissertations so they can have a sort of directed work group to help them progress in the writing, which is often the biggest barrier to completion in a program that requires a thesis or a dissertation. So anything we can think of that would help the students, we try to do that. One of the things we've been emphasizing recently is getting involved in mentoring undergraduate students, which is good for the undergraduate students, it's good experience for the grad students, and it also helps to make the case for the importance of graduate students on this campus, since, frankly, the budget is now principally driven by undergraduate tuition, to the extent that we can have an important role in the quality of the undergraduate experience on campus, it justifies the presence of grad students and differentiates us from the other campuses in the state, public or private. We have the biggest and most complete and highest level graduate programs in the state of Maine. We're the only real research university in the entire state. And that provides a different experience to students who come here, and I want to make that connection more explicit.
For the university's budget, you had mentioned that the larger portion of it comes from student tuition and not from the Maine state government.
Yeah, they've been crossing. When I came here 21 years ago, we were 70% state funded. Now we're 30-something percent state funded. And we're around 40-some percent tuition funded. So yes, it's now the biggest single contributor, tuition. And most tuition comes from undergraduates.
You said about 40% from undergraduates, about
37%. Well, no, 40% from tuition, 40-some percent from tuition in general. But most of that is from undergraduates because graduate students begin with, credit hours cost more, they take fewer credits. For instance, a doctoral student only has to take one per semester to be full-time. And a heavy load would be 9 credits, whereas a heavy load for an undergrad is 15 credits. So there are a lot more credit hours, and even though there's a price differential, that just a lot more. Then there are about 4 times as many undergrads as graduate students. And finally, out-of-state grad students almost never pay out-of-state tuition. Almost all of them come on some kind of assistantship. And when that happens, the university discounts the tuition, even if it's a grant, paying it down to the in-state rate, whereas out-of-state grad students pay out-of-state, undergrad students rather pay the out-of-state rate. So we add all those things together, the amount of the total tuition dollars that come from undergraduates is disproportionate compared to their number versus grad students, which is already 4-to-1. So it is the major, single biggest driver of revenue for the university, and the one that is probably most flexible. So if we could get more, then we would have more money. If we do the right things, we can get more undergraduate students. Whereas grad students, unfortunately, they don't bring in a lot of revenue. There's a cost associated to having grad students. I think it's what makes us a real university worth being at, both as a faculty member and as a student, including an undergraduate. But it's a case you have to constantly make, particularly in very tight economic times.
Certainly. Yeah. I'm slightly surprised. I realize that we've been in a recession for some time. But in speaking with other members of the Institute, I was under the impression that through the efforts of George Jacobson, George Denton, Stephen Norton, and I think
the faculty five.
Yes.
David Smith.
That the state government recognized the importance of funding the university, and since then it's been pretty supportive of the university.
That was really good in the late 90s and into the early 2000s. And it did get us the MEIF funding, which is still critically important. But for the last couple of years, there have been either cuts from the state or flat funding as costs have gone up. It hasn't been working. The state's cutting everything because the state doesn't have enough money. So we could have been cut more than we were, and that these days, this, you know, the chancellor says that counts as a victory that they didn't cut us. But costs go up. If the funding is flat, then you got to find the money somewhere else.
So tuition hikes.
Well, they haven't let us have tuition hikes either, so it's really more students.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the last, I think we're in the third year of no change in tuition.
I see.
And no change in state appropriation.
So what has been the primary strategy for just getting more students here?
They hired an enrollment, a vice president for enrollment management who's driven up the number of incoming freshmen. That's the main strategy.
Through advertising?
Through advertising and you know, selective aid packages and so on. And in particular, it's driven up the number of out-of-state undergrads because that gets you a 3-to-1 differential. They pay three times as much.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get 10 of those, it's like getting 30 Mainers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been... And I'll say he was successful. This is last year was his first year, and the incoming class was one of the largest ever. The previous several had been much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have to wait for them to work their way through to get back up to sort of our maximum capacity of undergraduates, and then we'll be in at least not as bad shape as we would be otherwise without that. You know, budgets are, they're never fun around here. I think there's, in my time here, which is 21 years now, there's only been 1 year when there was an actual increase, a real increase, not in the total dollars, because often that increases, but in the purchasing power of the dollars we have, whereas where they were actually able to add things instead of cut things once in 21 years, and probably more, because I can only go back that far. We've been so good at cutting without hurting, and without making the hurt obvious that everybody thinks we can just keep doing it, but it is a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
All, you know, you cut for all those years, there isn't much left.
Mm.
You know, and every cut now makes more of an impact because you're going into much more critical areas.
Does the strategy for just simply increasing student enrollment as a way of getting around the budget issues, does that create problems? Because then you need more faculty, more facilities.
It does, and those are hard ones to resolve. This year, there are more new faculty than probably the last 5 years combined. There's something like 29 new faculty, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
A university doesn't prosper if it doesn't renovate its faculty and bring in new blood and new people on a fairly regular basis, and we just hadn't been able to do much of that. But with, I guess, people leaving, hope for the future, they've gone ahead and hired a lot of people, and that's really, and they're really good people too. The ones that I've got a chance to meet are surprisingly good. It is a buyer's market in the academy, with the exception of a couple of fields. It'd probably be hard to hire a top-flight nursing educator at this point because there aren't any out there for anybody. Very few.
Mm-hmm.
There are enough places producing them. Business is hard to get because business people can go make more money in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you have to work harder to get really good people. But in any of the traditional academic disciplines, there are hundreds of qualified applicants that are qualified. I mean, they have a PhD at a minimum. Well, you know how I'm sure you've talked to people in history who've graduated recently.
Sure.
Do you know Stefano?
I do.
So you've probably talked to him about his job hunting experiences.
Yes.
And he's got a great record.
Mm-hmm.
But there are hundreds of people applying for those jobs.
Yes.
So as a buyer, as a seller, that's not so good. As a buyer, it would be criminal not to hire the very best because we can get them. We can get absolutely top-notch people.
Right.
And it looks like that's what we did from the ones that I've met. There was one of the new hires partly in the institute and partly because everybody's a joint appointment with something.
Mm-hmm.
But with actual money, salary from the institute, is a woman named Jacqueline Gill who's in biology, School of Biology and Ecology, SBE, mm-hmm. and the institute. I hadn't realized we'd hired somebody new, but I missed it last year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I met her at new faculty orientation and asked her what she did, and she said, "Oh, well, you know, I work on this thing." And it was megafaunal extinctions by studying the fungus from of megafaunal dung. You know, it's
fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of things people come figure out these things. But she said, "I said, oh, my research group read a paper in Science about that a couple of years ago." I said, "Yeah, that was my paper." So we just hired a beginning assistant professor who, before getting, you know, years before being hired, was the lead author in a paper in the top journal of any kind in the entire United States. Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad.
That's
the kind of people we're getting. Yeah. And the Institute, of course, with its reputation, really gets its pick because people want to be in the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
I even back, you know, 22 years ago when I applied, nearly 22, And I asked my advisors if they knew about the institute and what they thought. And the geologist who was on my committee, who was a very famous geologist, said, oh, they're probably the best institute focusing on these issues in the country. All University of Washington Quaternary Center can give them a run for the money, but Maine is better because they include the social scientists, the archaeologists, and anthropologists, and that makes them a more complete center. Mm-hmm. And that was many years ago when we were much smaller. Already, it had, you know, thanks to Hal and George and others, both Georges and, you know, and Dave Sanger and the rest, it had a great reputation, mm-hmm. and it's just grown from there. So, mm-hmm. the institute is a magnet. Right? People will come here because of it. So,
it's a remarkable story about building a world-class institution at a relatively small university yeah. with very limited resources.
Did Hal, have you talked to Hal yet?
We have, yeah.
So he told you a story about basically going in and telling the president he should do this, just as a fact that we're just talking to the president, okay, let's do it. Mm-hmm. Something, I mean, that's the version I got from him.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the letter written by President Libby
okay.
giving the go-ahead
cool.
for the formal creation of the Quaternary Institute.
Fantastic.
Which, interestingly enough, President Libby also indicated that that in no way entailed that they would receive any additional funding.
Well, and they didn't ever get a lot other than, you know, the faculty lines that were taken halfway out of units mm-hmm. and just reassigned to the Institute. Mm-hmm. But they were able, because it was such a good group of faculty, they raised the Bingham Trust money and so on. Mm-hmm. And there was this fellow Bonnicks, and he had a Center for First Americans, and he had a ton of money from outside. So a lot of what's made the Institute work, as I'm sure you know, is having this trust fund, which just generates a fair amount, right? It's over $1 million now anyway. It's probably much more than that. Mm-hmm. And so the income from that is what allows the Institute the flexibility to do things they didn't used to do. Mm-hmm. That, and I think Paul Maiescu was given a big chunk of the MEIF money to get him to come here. And so I know he's used some of that over the years to help the Institute. Mm-hmm. So it's garnered them, but not from traditional E&G budget, the general university budget. Mm-hmm. Which has been smart. Have you interviewed Professor Sanger yet?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know he told me once that he sort of, something to the effect that one day he woke up and got a letter saying you are now 50% of the Institute, 70% of the Institute. Mm-hmm. I recall, maybe I misremember, but I recall him saying that that he wasn't consulted, it just happened to him. Not that he was against it. I mean, he's a core member and it was always very much involved in the Institute's mission, but he said it wasn't, just happened that the president, on Hal Saiso, the president, just took a big chunk of over half his salary and moved it over into the Institute.
Yes, I require that. In fact, I now that you mention it, I recall that the dean at the time, whose name escapes me now, Professor Sanger, said that he was one who didn't really read the things that were put on his desk. He just signed them. And one of those documents one day was a paper which basically split him between archaeology and the Quaternary Institute. Yeah. So, since we've meandered back to the Institute, one of the things I'm curious about is the university-wide impact the Institute has had outside of the realm of climate science mm-hmm. itself. It seems to me that, of course, the efforts of Hal getting the first NSF grant.
Yes, that's a great story, too.
But then the work of George Jacobson and the Committee of Five to mm-hmm. get all kinds of money for the university. I'm wondering if you can comment about the role the Quaternary mm-hmm. Institute has played with the university.
Yeah. And again, I came in when, you know, some of those things had, many things had happened already. The Institute was formed, it had a 20-year history, but I was here for the Faculty Five and the creation of the MEIF. It's been transformational. Mm-hmm. It showed the university that we could be world-class outside of agriculture and forestry, which were the, you know, main-based natural resources that you would expect that we would be good in, that we could do straight academic stuff and be recognized internationally. I think that's been inspiring to many people to have that. And then the impact, of course, of getting the MEIF, that was mostly Institute members, George Jacobson and David Smith, now deceased historian. You must know who he is.
I've heard of him.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was a founding member of the Institute. Among the many things he did was climate history, fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, the impact of getting MEIF, we would probably be another USM now at that level if we hadn't got that money. Mm-hmm. in the late 90s, and it's been critical to the growth of the university. At the time they started to pursue that money, I think the university's annual extramural funding was about $10 million, and George Jacobson saying, well, we can be $100 million. Everybody thought he was nuts, and we're over $100 million. Mm-hmm. But 14 of that, or some part of it, 12 or whatever part of MEIF is ours, comes from MEIF, but it was the seed money they needed to ramp up everything else. Mm-hmm. All been absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that would be the single biggest impact, or those two things. One is just inspiring people with what we can do with the power of being interdisciplinary, and the other was getting the MEIF money that really re-jump-started research on campus and moved us up into being a much bigger player than we used to be.
Mm-hmm. I recall in speaking with Stephen Norton that he said when he first came here, he wouldn't really say that the University of Maine was a university in the sense that there wasn't much research going on.
It's true.
So do you think the Quaternary Institute has been pretty important to really making this a research university?
It's played a leadership role in bringing research into the dialogue, into the objectives of the campus. And because it is so interdisciplinary, it means there have been people throughout many different units involved in the institute, involved in the research, and in the research culture that the institute inspired. So, you know, you had David Smith in history, and David Sanger and others in anthropology, and you get people in earth sciences, people in biology. And right there you got four or five departments, very different departments, and it was spreading that mission throughout them, and people say, wow, you know, look what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could do this too. So yeah, it was, and it helped to attract funding, the MAF, but other money as well. It's been one of the most successful units since Hal got the first NSF ever. It's been one of the top units in getting external funding.
Mm-hmm.
And it still has an unbelievably high success rate. You've probably talked to Paul Majewski by now.
Yes, we have.
So he probably told you, or given you the annual reports about the success rate. You know, the national average is now down to 5%. It was 10% for NSF, and now we're like 70% or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or something, you know, many, many times the national average.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we're here, as you say, we're a middling university on the periphery. We're not one of the big players, and yet our success rate is very high because we have the people for it.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been really good for recruiting people. So for all those things, it's, you know, Paul is one of the absolute top scholars on campus, and he was recruited away from a senior position in New Hampshire because he wanted to live in Castine, I think, was part of it. But he wanted to be with the group of people in the Institute, with the culture of the Institute, and with the diversity that it's got. And then he's been transformational for the Institute.
I imagine that took some doing. I mean, he had, as you said, a full position at UNH.
Now, it took, George Jacobson did it. I mean, he made it happen, and it took a lot of negotiation on both sides to get the package that Paul needed to get Paul to agree to come, but it's been really good for us that he's been here. He is a, you know, a worldwide top scientist and brings a lot of students and colleagues and money and fame and connections. It's been and really good ideas for promoting the Institute.
Hmm.
So it's been very good.
I'm wondering, it seems to me that, as you said, Paul and his team have sort of changed the character of the Institute. I'm wondering if you can comment about that, past and present and future. Oh.
It's much broader than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
The original, you know, they had a couple of biologists, a couple of archaeologists, and a couple of earth scientists, and those are the three legs of the Institute traditionally. Now, and then a historian. Now, although we don't have a historian, I'm hoping that your new hire, Christina Adcock.
Adcock. Yeah.
Adcock. I'm hoping that she'll join. Her work is relevant. And would, you know, when she gets her feet on the ground, would make sense. We'd have a historian back in the Institute. But
sure, I believe she studies Arctic explorers.
She does.
Yeah.
So that would fit really well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've got not just archaeologists, but social anthropologists now from the anthropology department are members. We've got a much broader set of people from earth science. We've got lots of people from biology. We've got people from engineers. We've got a lot of engineers now. Never had engineers before.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, engineers do more than they used to in terms of working on climate-related issues. And just this whole slew of different kind of people. We have external people who are involved. It's become much more diverse. It's become much bigger. Excuse me. And that changes the social interactions to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still an emphasis on getting people together. I mean, they just all went off on the field trip now. I travel too much. I couldn't go. But, you know, that's been a traditional way of bringing people together. We had an event 2 weeks ago where all the faculty who came were supposed to stand up and talk about their work for 90 seconds with a maximum of one PowerPoint slide. So that the new students particularly would know who everybody was and what they did and could sort of then shop around for the right people. So we still do a lot of things. We have the Bourne Symposium in the spring every year. It's been called different things. That's what it is now. But most people are supposed to speak at that and talk about their work, and you spend 2 days together and build community. So community building has been a part of it. It's harder with as many people, but it still happens. The INT 500 course, same thing. The intent is to have the whole institute participate, and a pretty broad swath of them do. So, they still try to get everybody together and get people talking and crossing boundaries all the time. Harder with this many, but still doable.
Right. You know? But you think that, for example, you mentioned there are now engineers in the institute. What kinds of things are the engineers doing that contributes to our understanding of climate change?
Well, they work, for instance, on water issues. We've got an engineer who I think is in the institute. Well, one works on surface water flow. I know he's a member of the institute. There's another one who works on water chemistry and pollution, which often has climatic vectors associated with it. One of them works on tidal power, and so your tidal ranges, sea level changes, there are, implications for climate change on the things that the engineers are doing. So some of them produce climate-related data. Others need to know about it in order to do their work appropriately. The whole wind power effort, it clearly has, if wind patterns change from climate change, then it's going to affect all of that. So there's a lot more interaction across campus with people who weren't traditionally. A computer scientist is involved. He's been one of the, Jim Fastwick was an early member of the institute, but he's still involved. So we've got computer science. Marine science has become heavily involved. Fei Chai, for instance, is a member, and he works on the biological oceanography of, among other things, the Peruvian coast, and that's directly involved in climate change, both in measuring it and then in predicting the effects of climate change on productivity and things like that.
Would you say, then, that one of the ways that the Institute has changed is that there are more scholars examining issues closer to the present?
Oh, absolutely. The Institute has moved from a purely paleo perspective, and it was quaternary studies. Quaternary is really about the past, even though we're still in it. And now there's a much greater concern with policy. For instance, getting people like Jim Roscoe, who's a social anthropologist, involved. The adaptation to climate change, IGERT, which is really, it's not about the past. It's about moving forward and how we deal with these things. The policy component which has been essential to the growth of the Institute, has brought us into the present and given us a future-looking orientation that we didn't have before. Many of us still work principally in the past. I do, many others do. But we now have a whole bunch of other people associated who have a contemporary and modeling to the future perspective. And I think that's very healthy. I think it makes us a more relevant institute. We can take the long span of information that we've got, use it to test ideas about how climate works, where it's going, what might happen under certain other conditions that may have existed somewhat in the past, but we're now, people in the institute at least, are now looking towards the future. That's good.
When Paul Majewski came, you said that he really changed the character of the institute. I understand he studies ice cores and the ice core chemistry.
Yeah.
Aside from his own research, what has he done? Has he done anything that's changed?
He's helped push us to be broader, certainly been pushing the forward-thinking policy aspects, engagement with the state, Maine's Climate Futures publication of a couple of years ago, for instance, bringing people here who have an interest in contemporary and forward-thinking sorts of impacts of climate and so on. So He, although much of his work has been, until now, on paleo records, he thinks very much towards the future, and he's been trying to bring the Institute into that arena, I think quite successfully.
The publication, Maine's Climate Future, that was distributed where?
I couldn't say.
Okay.
You'd have to ask Paul, probably, or Betty Lee, she would know. Have you talked to her? Is she on your list?
No, I haven't.
She's the I don't know exactly what her, she's more than an AA. She's the one who runs all the budgets and everything for the Institute, and she's been with them pretty much since Paul arrived, so she's got a good perspective on the inside runnings of the Institute. She's involved in organizing an awful lot of what we do. So she would be a good person to talk to. Yeah.
But Maine's Climate Future, that was a product of the Climate Change Institute, and it was an effort at public outreach and public education.
Yeah, absolutely. We also have a public education person, Molly Schaffler. I don't know if she's on your list, but she is a graduate of the Institute, but her, she has some, I'm not exactly sure how she's funded, but she remains associated with the Institute, and her job is outreach to the public, to K-12, and all the other public venues, and then she sort of holds down that position for the Institute in terms of thinking about how we do that.
One final question. What do you think has been the Institute's most important contribution to our understanding of climate change?
That's a hard question. I think there are lots of contributions. Early on, it was improving understanding of past climates. Now, I think it's shifting into the realm of where are we going with climate and what are we going to do about it? Potentially, if this Iggert abrupt adaptation to climate change program really works well, the people who come through that program will become leaders in dealing with the climate crises of the future, and that will be a significant, very significant contribution that we make. So it changes. You know, research has changed over the years. The important thing is the Institute has remained at the forefront of the field as the field changes, and so continually makes important contributions both as a group and then in terms of the individual work of people like Paul and others who've made very significant contributions. And it remains a model of interdisciplinary interaction working pretty well. And it doesn't always work well. It should, but it doesn't. Many people, top scientists, don't know how to actually get together with somebody from another discipline and do productive joint work. I was on an NSF panel last year which solicited interdisciplinary proposals. And most of them came from very distinguished scholars who'd gotten lots of NSF money in their disciplines. And you could see that almost all of them, here's one guy, here's the other guy. And there's sort of a little bit in the middle that says, we're going to work together. But they had no idea how to do it. They had no plan how to do it. They clearly were written separately and not in lockstep the way a true interdisciplinary proposal would be. Nothing coming out of the Institute would be like that. People know how to do it. And it turns out that there are a lot of people in the country who don't know how to do it, and we can be a model for that. It was surprising. I thought that we were sort of a norm. And to go to this thing and see people who had been so successful disciplinarily try to do into sort of in reading their abysmal efforts at it was eye-opening.
Are there any formal expectations to do interdisciplinary research when you're hired into the Institute, or is it more informal?
In some way, it's more informal. It's the ethos of it. We get together, we talk together, we go on trips, we go to meetings, and you begin to realize that, hey, there's an overlap in what we do. Mm-hmm. What the Institute does from the perspective of a tenure-track faculty member who comes here and is, like I did, and has part of their money in the Institute, what that gets you is liberation to do interdisciplinary if you want to, because you're jointly reviewed now. You're not reviewed by a discipline. You're reviewed by a combination of Institute people and discipline people. And that means that whatever you do, if it's good work and it comes out in a decent journal, it's going to count positively towards your tenure. If you were in a single discipline and say we're publishing, say anthropology, and you're publishing in geology journals more than anthropology journals, you might be in trouble. There are places that wouldn't tenure you. In fact, I know somebody at Penn State who lost a job because they thought his the things he's probably good journals, but he was basically doing technical work and it wasn't really anthropology. And so they didn't even let him come for tenure. They got rid of him after 4 years. There are still places where that would happen. It would never happen for somebody who was a joint appointment, because the Institute presence on your committee means whatever you do that addresses anything within this incredibly broad area the Institute's interested in counts. And so that frees you up to take the chance to do interdisciplinary work, to publish in untraditional places, to do untraditional work. I said, I think I last time I counted, I was doing maybe 8 or 9 faculty colleagues who have worked with me in Peru who had never been there before. I took them the first time, many of whom keep coming back, made significant contributions to the research, because we're all free to do that. And we find each other and we figure out where we have interactions. Right now, you know, the group that I work with, it would principally be Alice Kelly, but Joe Kelly's involved, Dan Belknap is involved. For many years, Kirk Mosh and I did a lot of work together. We're trying to get back to that. So it just frees you up to do this, and who wouldn't want to work if you're free to do it in an interdisciplinary mode where you can have new ways to solve old problems and ways to see new problems nobody ever thought of before and then address them. It's very productive. But you have to have a structural situation that allows you to do it safely, and the Institute provides that.
Has that ever, that you know of, created an issue, where maybe a scholar was doing something outside of what his department traditionally does? Has that ever created an issue where, the Quaternary Institute expects you to maybe do things outside your department, but maybe the department itself?
I've never heard of that happening. This campus is really good about interdisciplinarity, even within the disciplines. There's an understanding that it's a good way to go, that it's successful, maybe because they've watched the Institute over the years continue to succeed, to garner fame and resources, and have people want to be associated with it because it's so well reputed, it does such good stuff, and they see that's a good model, it works. So that I have heard of, and I probably would have in the last 20 years if it happened, I've never heard of somebody getting in trouble from their disciplinary colleagues because they were working more towards the quaternary side than the discipline side. And it would be hard to do it because the committee, it's a joint review committee. Every year, as you're going through the pre-tenure process right up to the tenure review committee, there's equal representation. So somebody would have to explain why it is they thought it wasn't a valuable thing to do, whatever it was. And people aren't, I guess, for whatever reason, they probably don't believe it. They don't think it's not valuable, but if they did, they might not want to say it in an audience or in a committee where they're together with people from the Institute, most of whom tend to be quite distinguished. You know, you'd have to be pretty good yourself to be able to stand up and say, you know, what you're saying isn't worth anything. The work you do isn't worth anything. That's a hard thing to say when people are successful and sitting in front of you saying, you need to look at this positively because this is good work. University wants good work. I think the university, you know, as an institution, cares what you do, where you do it, as long as you do something that is high quality and well recognized. That's success. And the Institute was probably the first place to make that clear, that that could be in this broader interdisciplinary realm. So it's good. It's been a force for good. It's been fun to be part of it too.
Well, that's actually all the questions I had. But before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you an opportunity to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
Well, you covered it pretty well. I mean, the big thing about the Institute is how it succeeds in inspiring interdisciplinarity, and you touched on that very directly in the questions. I think that's the big story about the Institute, is that it brought people together to work productively, beginning at a time when that was just a sort of a thought in some people's minds, but it was not what it later became. Now it's the buzzword throughout the agencies. You know, interdisciplinarity, you got to do it. Well, there are good reasons for that. That wasn't true 40 some years ago when the Institute started. Institute was really ahead of the curve, and it's helped to lead the way. And that's both on this campus and probably more generally as a successful example of how you do it. There are a lot of places where it doesn't work, and there are units on this campus where it doesn't work. I've heard, I know sometimes people are joint appointed and the discipline in fact does exactly what you're saying and doesn't accept that their work that is not in the core area of the discipline is valuable work and worth tendering or promoting, and that's been a nasty business. But that's never been the case with the Institute. I mean, the departments that participate with the Institute buy into the mission, I think. They see the advantages of it. It also, it's interesting that the constituent departments tend to be among the strongest on the campus. And the departments I know that have made fuss about this kind of thing and with other kinds of connections outside of the department are among the weaker departments.
Could you, without, as much as you can say, could you give me a for example?
For example, somebody comes up for promotion and the peer committee, and the person is in sort of a side area related to another discipline, another unit. And I have to be very careful I say this. the peer committee consists of people who are from the core discipline. They basically, they don't quite say, we don't believe that what this other person is doing isn't really our discipline, although it's clear that that's what they believe. Instead, they'll say, well, you have to have 20 peer-reviewed publications to be promoted to full professor. And their document for tenure and promotion, which guides all this, absolutely doesn't say that anywhere. They take the external review letters. When you come up for tenure and promotion, the university solicits letters from experts in your field and takes, out of five glowing letters, takes the one slightly negative statement, which in the next sentence is completely qualified. So this is should under no circumstance be taken as a reason not to promote this person. Just takes the one sentence, the only thing they quote out of all the letters. Mm. Even though the rest of the letter is saying this person absolutely should be promoted and is very important, and that letter happened to be from a Nobel Prize winner, where any kind of praise would be quite high. You know, bias. Just clear bias, because they don't like the person. Yeah, that's probably enough. That's a real case. I hope that it's completely opaque as to where it could possibly be, but it has happened recently. Very unfortunate. And it is a case where the administration can act, because it is those decisions go through a chain, and each level can overturn the next level. And that particular one was overturned in the right way. The person got promoted as the person should have.
Mm-hmm.
So the system still works, but it obviously doesn't create a very good environment. This kind of place where you sort of expect that person being good to actually be looking for another job and take it soon. It'd be very bad for us. But...
Mm-hmm.
The Institute doesn't do that. It's not that the Institute doesn't have internal squabbles. It does. There are people who can't stand each other even within the Institute. I'm hoping you haven't picked up on any of that, but it is true.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Of course.
Nevertheless, as a unit, as an organization, it works extremely well. And that has, to my knowledge, has never played out in anybody's review, tenure, or promotion decision ever. It's always been totally about the output, the work they've done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
A good organizational culture.
Well, good. Well, thank you once again for...
Oh, it's a pleasure.
...sharing all of your thoughts. And go ahead and stop the interview now.
Well, I'm glad you're wrong.